Good afternoon. My name is Gina Evans, and I'm an assistant professor at the Baylor College of Medicine, and I am bringing up the rear of the other wonderful presentations, and my presentation will be kind of an underlying theme of the other ones of how do you have a culturally inclusive research program. Clinical trials are conducted to explore the safety and efficacy of new prevention, diagnostic, and treatment methods for disease. Oftentimes, when we think of clinical trials, we first think of pharmaceuticals. Well, actually, a basic intervention or a basic research program that just compares the difference between two treatments or treatment and non-treatment is kind of a trial. So trials are important in a lot of our different lines of research. There are different phases of clinical trials, and they are both good parts and bad parts of trials. The good parts are they often advance our health. They're good for advancing the health status of vulnerable populations. The downside is they're oftentimes very costly. In the last stages of clinical trials, they can cost multiple millions of dollars, and they can extend anywhere from 5 to 8 years. Much like this room, the world we live in is very diverse. Currently, we have a third of our citizens that are ethnic minority. We have, in the future, we'll have over 20% that'll be Hispanic Americans, over 14% that'll be African American, and over 8% that'll also be Asian Americans. As we know, with the baby boom population, we're all getting a little older, and by the year 2040, there'll be over 80 million Americans who are above the age of 65. We also currently have over 24 million individuals that are living with a physical disability. Unfortunately, the most vulnerable people are amongst the sickest of the sick, such as the elderly and the disabled and the ethnic minorities, and generally have the worst health outcomes once we do contract an illness, and we usually have comorbid diseases, which means we usually have more than one illness. Unfortunately, the people who are the most ill and the most sick and have the worst health outcomes are often the least represented in clinical trial research. Despite the NIH mandate, that's been over a decade, of the inclusion of ethnic minorities and women in clinical trial research, vulnerable populations still constitute less than 10% of all clinical trial participants. The common barriers for vulnerable participants include a cultural mistrust, differences in languages, the perceived harm of participating in clinical trials, the cost of participation. A lot of times people can't afford to take the time off of work to travel to clinical trial sites. They may not have the transportation to get there because places may not be on the bus line or the metro line. They often have family issues if they are caring for ailing or elderly parents or children. And a lot of times there's just a lack of knowledge about what a clinical trial truly is. For researchers, on the other hand, there's an increase in study costs. It costs 3 times more to recruit a vulnerable population, such as an ethnic minority or an adolescent, than it does a European American. Of course, since you have a higher recruitment rate, you have a longer length of your study. There are cultural barriers also for the researchers. And there's a lack of cultural awareness sometimes. And a lot of times, there's just no incentive if you're not federally funded to do your research. And majority of the research is funded by pharmaceutical and private industry. For example, my personal research looks at disease self-management among ethnic minorities who usually have diabetes or some cardiovascular disease. I currently have a study at a level 1 trauma community hospital where I apply a disease self-management intervention to primarily ethnic minorities and Hispanics who are underinsured and are poor. My study was based off of another study where a group of researchers provided a disease self-management program and acute care to primarily white and insured participants. The same study, but different participants in different settings. My recruitment took 11 months, whereas theirs took 3 months. My retention rate was 68%, whereas theirs was 98%. And discussing with the participants their personal barriers with continuing in the studies, it was often a lack of contact information, such as when you're in the hospital and you're dependent on a job, the longer you're in the hospital, you're not making money. If you don't have any money, you're not paying your bills, you're not able to buy groceries, And a lot of times when you leave the hospital, depending on how long you're in there, you've missed a paycheck, which now you're behind on your bills. And a lot of times creditors just aren't very compassionate about letting you make a payment plan or letting you stay in an apartment that you're already behind on rent. So they have to move with relatives or move somewhere else. So a lot of times their contact information changed. There was financial barriers, such as they had to work extra hours to make up for the pay that they lost while they were in the hospital. They had financial issues, childcare issues, and transportation issues. And unfortunately, the people that participate in our research studies don't live in a bubble. They don't just focus on our particular research study. They still have to go on with their life. They still have to go on with their problems and their bills. So a lot of times people still need additional help, such as, can you help me find a financial resource to help me pay the rent that I've missed while I've been in the hospital? Or can you help me find a social services that will provide some food stamps so that me and my children can eat? And contrary to popular belief, vulnerable populations do participate in research, and they are willing to participate in research. It's just that they have barriers to their participation. So to decrease some of these barriers and increase their recruitment, we need to have a more culturally inclusive program of research. It's important that we understand how culture influences our behaviors. It's important that researchers attempt to integrate culture into the training, the research design, and the recruitment and retention. A lot of people don't realize that there are national standards such as the Cultural and Linguistically Appropriate Service, the CLASS Act, that NIH has put out. It is actually a mandate saying that anyone who receives federal funding must abide by these mandates to improve the inclusion of vulnerable populations in their research. Unfortunately, a lot of people have never heard of the CLASS Act. And I haven't put all of the mandates on my slides, but if you would like to find out more information, I've included a website at the bottom. It's www.bcm.edu/edict. And on the website, it has all of the CLASS Act mandates that anyone who receives federal funding must abide by. They also will form the basis of the rest of the presentation in how to actually apply the CLASS Act standards in the planning all the way through the dissemination phase to improve cultural inclusivity in any kind of research, not just clinical trials. For step one, which is the planning stage, it's important that you choose an easily accessible recruitment site, such as a county hospital or a county clinic, or a community center or a social service agency, or just someplace that will be easily accessible by a mass transit system. It's also important that you gain community involvement early. As academics, sometimes we feel that we know best and that we have all the research knowledge that we need to plan an effective study. However, we may not have the information needed to access the groups that we are wanting in our research study. So we have to open up the lines of communication to individuals in the community who do have that information, such as clergy or community leaders. We must treat all participants and community members with respect and compassion. It sounds simple, but a lot of times that just does not occur in research studies. We also should use culturally appropriate intervention materials and assessment materials. How often have all of us read research studies that reported statistics and the intervention and assessments that we've used that say they're valid and reliable, but never mention the original population on which the assessment or intervention was developed on? If you have an assessment that's developed on one population, but you use it on different populations, you may not necessarily be gaining the exact same information because of cultural differences and the different way that questions are answered sometimes are perceived different. So the findings in that research study may be skewed. And we also need to increase cultural awareness of the acceptable and unacceptable practices, such as my fellow panel members who are doing research with Hispanics and African Americans. We've all touched on the fact that there are very cultural differences, such as you mentioned that a lot of times the whole family would show up at a recruitment site. Well, amongst the Hispanic and African American community, the family is very important. So we have to understand that that's an acceptable practice for them, is bringing their family to everything that they do and including their family into all of their major decisions. So we have to gain an understanding of what's acceptable and what's unacceptable. For step two, which is the retention and recruitment procedures, again, it's important to incorporate family and friends. to hire multicultural and bilingual research staff, because we do have different cultural languages, and the more that you provide compensatory strategies to include different populations, the more generalizable your findings will be, and the more you decrease your exclusion criteria. It's important that we use translators and interpreters, and that we provide study incentives that are applicable for the people that we're studying. Now, I'll be the first to admit that money is a motivator. It motivates us to do a lot of things. However, money is not always the best incentive for individuals. Some studies have shown that individuals would rather receive a food cart so they can buy their groceries. For those who do have a car for transportation, gas is about $10 a gallon now. So a gas card sometimes would be a better incentive to help people get back and forth to work. Also, just to provide additional needed resources, they provide us a service. Participants are providing us with the information to help us do our job or do our passion. It's important that we also give something back to them. We can take a little bit of time to provide them with additional resources or a referral for anything that they may need that may not directly be tied to our study, such as people may need a referral for another community health service, or they may need a referral for another organization for employment. I'm not saying that we all need to become social workers, but we do have a responsibility to appreciate them as being participants in our research study. As far as data collection, we need to be flexible with the hours that we do data collection. Simply having data collection during 9 to 5 does not work for a lot of people who have jobs. We need to do things such as provide home visits if it's feasible to collect the data for people who don't have transportation or who cannot easily alter their schedule to come in to provide data collection to us. We need to be acceptable to the fact that there may be somebody that may need to watch someone's child while they come in and provide us the information we need. We may need to go to them and bring them to us, or maybe pay for a cab for them to come to us. But just do compensatory measures to help them continue to participate in our studies. And a lot of these can be alleviated by using health and community educators who know the community intimately and already know how to get around certain things. And lastly, we need to have a return to the community. We need to share our research studies with the leaders, not just come in, use their resources, and leave. In the beginning of the talks, in the planning stage, we need to discuss with people how can we sustain future efforts with your community based on the findings that we have. How can we implement future screenings in your community, or how can we come back and do educational trainings based on the information that we gathered from your community? We need to return the results just into future programs to help leave something for the community, to help decrease the distrust that we have against academicians and vulnerable populations to participating in our research. Doing these things cannot also improve our retention recruitment of vulnerable populations in any research study. It can also help to address the health disparities problem. The more generalizable our findings are, the better we can provide accurate health care to different populations and improve their health status. Again, I also have no personal problems or disclosures for this presentation. And I would like to have a special thanks to the initiative that allowed this presentation to occur. It's Eliminating Disparities in Clinical Trials, which is also on the EDICT website. There's a lot of recommendations above and beyond the ones that I've mentioned here to help give you an idea of how we can increase vulnerable population participation in research in general. And I'd also like to give a special thanks to Armin Weinberg for helping me place this presentation together.
Well, I'd like to give another round of applause to Clarice, Bonnie, Stephen, Al, and Gina for their really insightful presentation, so thank you all very much. I must have really been scary before the session started because we're really running early. So I hope that you have a lot of questions, and we will open it up for questions to any and all of the panelists for those who can stay. Yes, in the back.
Well, our project currently doesn't use kiosks. It's a recommendation that I think is going to be important for those individuals who don't have home access. Right now, the project will be an internet web-based initiative, but we're going to be working with our community partners to talk about ways in which we can improve community access. For example, our local YMCA has a technology center in their facility that's relatively underutilized. So that could be an opportunity to increase utilization of that technology center and also provide information to consumers about our website and other sources of health information. And I think as our other panelists was talking about, the importance of kiosks for use in places such as primary care clinics and in hospital emergency rooms, places where people may not have traditional access, where they're spending a lot of time waiting for services and where they can be learning something useful. So I think there'll be a number of strategies that can be employed.
What we did is we just picked from Google those sites that immediately came up when we did the Google search, and I can tell you quickly in terms of, I can't remember off the top if we had any for-profit ones. I don't remember any off the top that came up. Well, what I do know is that as a standard rule, they all failed both literacy levels in terms of the target audiences, and only one of them passed in terms of 508 accessibility. And that's really a critical point, because for folks who may not be able to read at a certain level, if it passes at 508, then the text reader can read it orally. So if you can't read the information because of the literacy level, you can at least hear the information. But if it doesn't 508, then it's not going to be able to translate that either.
Back there. I'm sure that there has been outcome research done. We haven't conducted any. I think it would be really interesting to see, make comparisons between how a photo novella fares with these audiences versus regular translation, or even a culturally appropriate translation that's simply a brochure or pamphlet. But I'm not aware of those. We use photographers. She asked if we worked with a photographer for doing the photo novellas. We do work with photographers, really, when we do any sort of public health campaign or anything like that involves photography.
And do they have a health education background?
That's a good question. Not usually. Right. So we have graphic designers on staff who work on health promotion materials, and they have knowledge of health programs and things like that. So aside from being able to inform the photographer about how things are going to be laid out, they can also inform things from a health perspective that they've experienced in working in the field.
Can you repeat the question, please?
At their rate of participation? I don't think that there's any difference. I think both the urban and rural communities are underrepresented in trials, but both are wanting to participate in clinical trials more. As far as the response to participation, I am not sure if the percentage of difference in response of those that participate in clinical trials, I know that both populations are still very much underrepresented. They are both less than 10% as far as participating. And since they are both underserved groups, they both have the exact same barriers to participation. But I don't think there's a decrease in the need to recruit more in both populations. Mm-hmm. Yes, a lot of the recommendations in a particular session of the edict policies recommends better communication between doctors and physicians in educating their patients about clinical trials and how to facilitate that occurring in a policy recommendation. And I know just a lot of physicians fear that if they discuss clinical trials with their participants and something goes wrong, then that will come back on the physician. When in actuality, we're just encouraging physicians to discuss the availability of clinical trials. That would be something that would be applicable for their particular patient and their health condition.
Anything else?
Yeah, we did look at whether or not they had access to care and whether or not they had private as well as public insurance and so on, in addition to their health status, their perceived health status, and their level of reported chronic disease and so on. And basically what we found was that those individuals who have fared a poor health status reported in general less utilization or less access to the internet. However, when you were able to correct that, and if they had access to the internet, their interest in using the internet for finding information was high. And I think the other issue was, as you were saying, about the importance of the providers, their general interest in getting information was, or the trust in information was highest with the provider. If they had not that level of involvement with other sources, they weren't able to get that support from other resources. So providers were key. And I think that's why we were talking before about health literacy. Those individuals who were non-users tended to have lower levels of involvement in finding and utilizing health information. So providers were key in trying to be that backstop, that second level of defense in providing information to consumers. How well they were able to do that is another issue. We weren't able to tease that out in our findings.
I used to work at the public hospital system in Chicago with physician faculty development and so are on the outside. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that my physician colleagues complained about was that they were often be approached by university-based researchers to help them recruit into clinical trials. Mm-hmm. But and the hospital-based, public hospital-based physicians had very limited to participate in research. They were interested in it, but they felt that the university-based researchers often didn't treat them as colleagues, didn't invite them as, you know, co-investigators, and so, you know, they had limited incentive to help with the recruitment of patients. I was just wondering if that was the question.
I think that's addressed more along the lines of involving the community, because public physicians would be in the community. So involving the community in the planning stages throughout the dissemination stages of clinical trials. Again, the public physicians have a better access to that population. And like I said before, sometimes as academicians, we think that we have a better understanding of how to conduct research, but not necessarily a better understanding of how to access the population that need our services the most. So I think our recommendations recommend that we engage the community and the community physicians early in the dissemination, in the planning stages, so that they can work as colleagues and can be equals. Right. And then leave when you're done. So that would be under our policy recommendation of engaging the community as equals and treating them with respect as equals throughout the entire process.
Other comments? Yes.
Mm-hmm. And how to get that actually enforced as well.
Well, thank you all very much for coming. I know that all the presenters will be around for a few minutes to answer individual questions, but thank you again and have a nice afternoon. Everybody did a great job staying on time.
With that whip. He cracked the whip early. And you're just like,
my husband would listen as well. God, I gotta tell him. I'm a real hard nose.
Hi. Sure.
Yes. Even for survey.
I can tell you about my own personal experience with my study at the hospital. Well, at Baylor, we have mandated things that have to be in our consent form. And for us, they have to be appropriate to the level of reading that for the population that. So after we downgraded it to the most basic language, you would be surprised at how difficult that is. Even when you think it's lower, and somebody review it, they're like, no, you need to do it lower than that. So after we downsized it to the appropriate readability level, then my form was still 12 pages long, and that was like a 10-inch font. So for me, what I did was I went through the consent form with the individual and said, you know, before we begin, there's some things that I need to tell you and some things I need to explain to you. And I would just go over, not in detail, not in word for word, because that is very tiring, but I would just go over, you know, basically, you have the right to withdraw at any point in time. Your data is safe, it is safely stored in place. And I just went over the main points with them and talked to them about it. And then what I did was I had them sign it and I gave them a copy to take with them. So I was like, and here is a copy that you can read through more thoroughly at your time. And my business card is on the top page. So if you have any questions about anything, you can go through it with your family, with your physician, with whoever you want to read on it. please feel free to call me at any time. So I would hit the highlighted points, the important points, and then give them a copy to take home with them with my business card for them to read. And I had somebody really read it. Yeah, and called me, and I was more than happy to explain, you know, he was like, well, what happens, you know, when the study's over, what do you do with my information? Well, I have to keep it for so many years, and then I shred it. I mean, I answered every single question, but that's what I did. Because it's already hard for them to read at a, for us, I mean, we're at like a fourth or sixth grade. So it gets overwhelming. So I help them through it, and then if you sort of go over this to somebody else, please feel free to give me a call, and it's less overwhelming that way. And say, read it over, and then I sit there and wait for you to read it all, and then halfway through you're like, I don't even want to pull through anymore. I make it conversational. So I use that as a tool for us to build a rapport.
Yeah.
And for me to get to know you and you to get to know me, because I've had people with their kids hanging on me. And just, you know, I use it as a tool of us discussing, having questions, is everything okay? Well, now let me go into some of the questions.
Thank you.
No problem. Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Do you want to use my camera?
Of course, I can do that.
Okay. Because I actually brought my camera too.
Sorry, I got here a few minutes later.
There you go.
Click on the
VIP.
Oh, the sign? Too low to take
pictures. Okay. Did it just shut down?
No, it's got a fish on it.
About to show me all your private pictures.
Okay, we'll try this. Okay.
Okay.
sounds like it's good. It's good there's water, though. That's true.
Andrew, where are you from?
Okay, and you're from
here.
From
LA. Yeah.